It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for Feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm hosting your show this morning. And this is Fed Talk's Maiden Reporters Roundtable. We are extremely honored and pleased to be able to bring you some of the three top reporters who cover the federal beat here inside the Beltway. With me today in the studio is Sean Riley from the Federal Times. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you to the Roundtable. I've dubbed it that. I've given it a name. Thank you to the for joining us in the Roundtable, and thank you for being part of our Maiden show. Sean Hicks of the Washington Post. Sean is the reporter who does the Federal Eye blog, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners read daily. And Josh, thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be here.
And with us also, but by phone, is Kelly Lunny of GovExec. Kelly, you with us?
I'm here.
And Kelly is a reporter at GovExec, and she covers pay and benefits and the budget process, as do Sean and Josh. All of the reporters that we have with us are very sort of inside the Beltway kind of people, reporting on the same topics important to federal employees. And I thought that before we sort of got into what you're all covering now and, you know, what you see to be the trends and where things are going, I thought we'd go around the table and find out from each of you how you got onto the federal beat. Because when I looked at your backgrounds, all of you came from somewhere else. And it's like, how did he end up covering the federal beat? And Josh, if you don't mind, I'd like to start with you. You have the Federal Eye blog at The Washington Post.
Yep. Well, before being at The Washington Post, I was out in Seattle for about 6 years, working for just small community papers out in the Seattle suburbs as a general assignment reporter. Then I came to the Post in 2012 when they were, in 2011 when they were kind of ramping up for the 2012 election. I started to work with the Fact Checker blog, so I was kind of handing out.
We used to read that all the time.
Yeah, it's especially during the election time, you get so many kind of misleading statements. So we're pretty active around that time, and so, you know, just being, you cover a lot of different topics with the Fact Checker and of course as a general assignment reporter too when I was in Seattle. And so I think it kind of translates well to this type of work because the federal government is so broad, mm-hmm. So many different agencies, so many different issues. And so I guess, you know, I'm able to maybe parachute into topics pretty quickly and figure them out and still getting a hang of things. You know, I've only been with this beat less than a year, so still getting everything straight in my mind and
the
figuring
alphabet
out how things
soup.
Work. Yeah, exactly. So, but it's been a good time, and I really like the beat.
Kelly, what about you? You've been with GovExec for a while. Tell us how you got interested in the federal beat.
Well, when I first moved to Washington in '97, I didn't have a job, and I started working as a temp for the Housing and Urban Development Department. So I became very well acquainted with federal agencies and how they work. And for people who don't work in the government, it's a foreign universe.
So it's a universe unto itself.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I decided, I worked there for about a year and a half, 2 years. And at that time, the secretary was Andrew Cuomo, and I went from being a temp to a career employee. And I worked in the Office of Executive Secretariat, so I was responsible for writing his thank you notes. Mm. And he was very interested in having all of his thank you notes to people be different, so he wanted them all to say something different, which was why I had the job that I had. And I decided that I was interested in journalism. I hadn't reported or done anything like that in college, but I was interested in writing, and so I applied for a job as government executive, and they were thrilled to have somebody that actually had worked at an agency and wanted to translate, go into journalism and sort of knew that world coming in, because it is a real specialized area, and it can be complicated. It's not just sort of, you know, covering the horse race stuff in politics. You really sort of have to have a good handle on things and be precise, because if you get something wrong, your readers will tell you.
That's right. The federal community is very good about that.
Absolutely, and I appreciate that. So I got into that that world, and I worked for a government executive for a few years, and then I took a job with our sister publication, National Journal, and I did sort of more policy, straight policy, politics type stuff. And then I came back to GovExec in 2008, and it was a good time for me to transition back, and it was a good fit because I obviously knew the issue areas, and it was, you know, getting to be that time when the budget process became very important, and the 2010 elections came in, and pay and benefits issues really sort of got to the forefront of a lot of budget issues in Congress. So it was sort of a new arena that I got to jump into, and it's been, you know, pretty exciting the last few years.
Yeah, well, Congress has certainly kept us all on our toes.
Absolutely.
I think they're becoming the boy who's cried wolf, though. I think we all know what they're about to do, you know, as we move through the next set of budget cycles. And Sean, you're at the Federal Times. You also cover pay and benefits. You've been there since 2010?
Yeah, that's right, Deborah. I'm basically a wonk at heart. I majored in political science. I've covered government at all levels throughout my my career. When I first came to Washington, I was working for an Alabama paper, essentially covering the state congressional delegation and federal agencies' actions as it affected the state. But, you know, the government, it's a fascinating animal.
It really is.
And there's so much going on with it. You know, you think about the entire federal workforce, including the Postal Service, it's about 2.5 million people. That's a pretty good-sized city if you put everyone together. And it really doesn't get enough attention, in my view, which is one reason I moved to Federal Times, just because I think there's a lot of material there. When I came out in 2010, I had no idea exactly what was coming, but I think we're in a really transformational period.
Yeah.
I don't know where it's actually heading, but it's a fascinating point to start covering it.
Sean, you know, I want to follow up with you on that point. I always like to tell people I've been servicing the federal communities for almost 24 years, practicing law, where my clients are federal employees and federal officials. 24 years, it's like, it's so hard for me to process that amount of time. It's gone very fast, but it is transformational. And I've always said to people who don't really understand what I do when I leave the Beltway, right, that the largest single cohesive employer in the world is the federal executive branch. When you don't include the Postal Service, they hover around 1.9 million. When Al Gore reinvented government, it dropped down to 1.8. It jumped up under the George Bush during the two wars. It jumped up around 2 million, 2.1. But it always hovers around 1.9. And when you think about 1.9 million people all working for the same top person, right? It's just really an enormous enterprise. And it moves very slowly, but it does feel in transition, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, obviously we're experiencing the impact of sequestration right now. There's, you know, we clearly don't know what's going to happen at the beginning of the October of 2014 fiscal year in October. But it clearly is moving in very, very slowly. And I think somewhat, without a clear direction at this point, but I've been struck by the number of reports, number of studies that come out in the last year or so, which are saying essentially something's got to change, particularly in response to these budget pressures, because those are not going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Kelly?
Deborah, that is such a good point that you made and puts it in perspective, just how large the workforce is. And it's amazing when you think about it that it works as well as it does. I think people kind of lose sight of that. There are so many people and so many moving parts, and you know, we do spend a lot of time, reporters, you know, are guilty of this as well, sort of focusing on the negative, focusing on the inefficiencies and mismanagement, and there's certainly several examples of those, but there's a lot of great stories, too. There's a lot of things that that work well and that don't get screwed up, and, you know, a lot of times people lose sight of that.
Well, I think, frankly, most of what the federal workforce does works well and doesn't get screwed up. But I think it's true, and I have three reporters with me today, I think it's true about how the American media covers everything, that it's only about exploiting something that, you know, you feel like you're watching a train wreck. It's either very negative or it's catastrophic. And I think that the media, maybe because they have to fill 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, maybe they feel that that's how they keep a story going. But most of what, almost everything of what the federal government does when it opens its doors every day is it does something good. I think that, and I can't remember, I went online last night and I read Josh's blog, and Kelly, I went on GovExec, and I went on Federal Times, Sean, and I read whatever's up there. And one of you wrote about a woman who's been nominated for the SAMMYs, the head of National Institute for Health Drug Abuse. And she was featured on 60 Minutes. I don't remember which one of you wrote about it.
Yeah, that was me with the Federal Live.
Yeah.
It's Nora Volkow. She was head of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And
It's nice to see that in the midst of, just reporting on near catastrophes every time or the negatives that Congress, is able to exploit a mistake a federal employee's made. That's the other transformation, Sean, I've seen. So if you look back, I don't think any of you have been covering it as long as I've been practicing, but if you look back even 10 years, there just wasn't this intensity to find a mistake that a federal employee made and then use it to make some grander point. What's your sense of, any of you, what's your sense of what that does to covering the federal beat and getting people to talk to you?
It makes it harder because definitely I think there is constantly concern about how, and I was actually just met with communication staff of a federal agency a couple weeks ago. And, you know, one of the difficulties in covering the federal government as opposed to state or local governments is much more opaque. It's much more difficult to get direct access to decision makers and policymakers. And one reason for that, I don't think it's the only reason, but one reason is I think is they're becoming increasingly aware that one misstep, one quote taken the wrong way or can have severe repercussions, particularly when, you know, you're talking about the internet, cable TV, and all of a sudden what you say is all over the air. And so they're becoming, I think federal employees have always been cautious. I think now in many cases, particularly, the folks that we deal with in the public affairs office being hyper cautious, and that makes it much more difficult. To be honest, I think it also gets in the way of getting some of the good news stories out because they are so concerned about, again, any possible misstep that they're reluctant to allow any direct access to the people who actually are in charge.
Kelly?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with everything Sean said, and it's frustrating, and you can understand where they're coming from because you know you see the stories. You just look at IRS,
right?
And it's frustrating because, as Sean says, there's a lot of good stories out there, and they, you know, don't get fully fleshed out because people are afraid, and public affairs folks won't let the people doing the jobs talk because they're afraid that they're going to say something that they shouldn't. I think, you know, unfortunately, the other side of that is if you don't have people talking to you and giving you information, you don't always get the story right.
Right.
And that can be frustrating, you know, for reporters as well, because I think all three of us really try hard to get everything right and get at the truth as best as we can. But if we don't have people talking to us and explaining things to us, we're sort of left kind of out there in limbo trying to figure things out for ourselves.
And I want to talk more about this point about where this, you know, where this transformation in our government is heading. You know, what does it mean for the greater good of all of us? There are some good stories out there. Josh did pick up the SAMMY nominee, which I was really pleased to see a whole profile on her. But we do need to take our first break for our listeners. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around a mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said, it's a thought. But Gecko sounds like Geico. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. Geico.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact Geico today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm hosting our show this morning. I've called it the Reporters Roundtable. With me, joining me in today's show, are three reporters who cover the federal beat. We have Kelly Lunny of GovExec. We have Sean Riley of the Federal Times. And we have Josh Hicks of the Washington Post, who writes the Federal Eye blog. If you have a question or a comment for any of my guests, please feel free to give us a call. You can call us toll free. We're at 1-877-936-9333, or you can send your question or comment by email to us. Our email address is fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. So, Josh, before we went to the break, we were there was a conversation going about the transformation in government and how it was making it more difficult for reporters to cover stories, and that the transformation was also about really just, you know, the media picking up the negative that's out there. And like I said last night, I was on your blog. Not that I'm not always reading your blog, but, you know, I was reading your blog to get ready for the show. And how pleased was I to see that? It's just so, you know, these people who go to work, 1.9 million people, almost all of them really, they do it because they have a calling. They really feel connected to public service. I think the Sammys are terrific. And what inspired you just to throw that into your blog? And, you know, is it a slow news cycle here in August?
It's not just that. I think I do get a sense sometimes with the Federal Eye that there is, you know, so much focus on, I mean, one of our biggest missions is accountability and keeping an eye on the government. So we do want to look and see what's going on, but in terms of accountability. But sometimes I worry that maybe it is... I may look at five straight blog posts that seem to be focusing on negative things, and it's good to kind of throw into the mix there something that highlights some of the good work that federal workers do. I think they a lot of federal workers feel like they're kind of under a microscope these days. Maybe mm-hmm. always they felt that way. You know, mistakes happen in the workplace. People don't always do things perfectly. In the private sector, you know, you may have to answer to your boss if something goes wrong, or your boss may have, you know, may have not overseen a program so well, and so there are some problems in the private sector, obviously too, but it's not quite so public. You know, if something bad happens, like with the IRS, that then it's the whole nation knows about it, and they're kind of I think they feel some added pressure after that, some added scrutiny, and it can be a tough work environment, and it can be tough on morale for them too, I think. So yeah. We just wanted to highlight a little more of the positives.
Yeah, no, it was nice, and I'm sure she appreciated it. You know, Sean and Kelly had commented, Josh, before the break about the difficulties they've started to experience in getting people to talk to them so they could cover a story. Are you finding that too?
Yeah, well, even with that profile, I didn't actually write that profile that we were just talking about with the drug abuse researcher, but Nora Volkow, but actually she didn't interview for that, for her own profile. So sometimes you have to kind of report around people when they, you know, when they're nervous about that. And I don't know exactly why she didn't do an interview, but I don't know if it was because of nerve. She was, you know, concerned about some kind of backlash or anything. I don't want to speak for her, but anyways, she didn't talk to the reporter for that profile. And even for my own, I mean, we're doing kind of a series right now on all these Sammys finalists. And so even for my own profile, I'm profiling somebody from the IRS, their chief information officer, and who came from a long career in the private sector, actually. And that was even tough. I mean, after all the IRS coverage that I've done on this supposed IRS targeting scandal, to then come back and ask them.
I love the word scandal, too,
yeah.
by the way.
Well, scandal. I should say controversy. It's definitely a controversy.
I love the word scandal.
Yeah.
If you listen to Fox News, it's like, everything's a scandal. It's like, okay, well, whatever, but go on.
Yeah. Well, it was even tough. I could sense their reluctance in there. So what is this again? I try to show them other articles. Look, this is a profile. Here's three other profiles we've done about these semifinalists. This is not some kind of an expose. This is to look at the good work that he's done. He had kind of a turnaround there in terms of their, making the IRS work a little more efficiently and effectively. So we just wanted to see exactly what he had done. But the reason I brought up the fact that he was from the private sector is because he had a very long career there, and he's about almost 65 years old right now, so he's around retirement age.
Yeah.
So he could definitely just retire and call it good, and he probably has financially he's probably doing just fine, but he said that he had this calling, and so this at this point he's probably not making as
Isn't
much money as he did at
65 years old.
He still comes back and he says, this is my service. This is a service to my country. I wanted to help the IRS kind of fix these long lasting problems. And so, it does speak to their sense of civil service.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Sean, do you feel when you're doing reporting that you have an obligation? I mean, I get what Josh is saying about, especially because the name of his blog is called The Federal Eye, that, he's got an eye on the government, and accountability is sort of the word of our decade. And if you're inside the government, accountability feels like, oh my gosh, here comes the heavy hammer. But when you do reporting and you're talking to people, do you feel any sense of concern about the consequences to these people that you're reporting on, or the story you're reporting on, the consequence to the agency because of the negativeness in the news cycle?
Maybe a little more sensitive. I think, as Kelly said, you always want to get the story right. And that means, providing a fair, objective, as much as possible approach to reporting and writing. And I think nowadays, particularly working for a publication like Federal Times as opposed to a more mainstream news outlet, I think you are a little more sensitized to the potential ramifications of anything that that might come out. So I think I try even a little harder than I would have otherwise.
Yeah, I was curious about that, particularly because you were Federal Times. Kelly?
Yeah, I agree. And I think that part of it, too, because all three of us report inside the Beltway, and, our beat is the federal beat, executive branch, but part of that is obviously covering Congress and all the other political sort of apparatus. And, you see how agencies and federal workers are used for political purposes. And so a lot of times when you hear testimony on the Hill, IRS is a great example. You see the back and forth between Daryl Issa and Elijah Cummings and reporters who report on this stuff every day. It's so clear to me, and I'm sure Josh and Sean feel this way too, how the rhetoric is being used and for political purposes, regardless of what agenda you're trying to push. And that sort of makes it harder because we do have that knowledge, and we can say to ourselves, yeah, there is mismanagement there. Was it politically motivated? Probably not. There's mismanagement in a lot of agencies. And you sort of, because we have that knowledge and we've been reporters for so long doing this, we can sort of see where the gray area is.
Mm-hmm. Josh, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I think, I was just thinking.
Because I saw you shaking your head when she was speaking.
Well, I was just thinking, she's right, I think. Any agency, any department of any agency, if you get your locker tossed, they're going to find something wrong in there. So I don't think anybody's immune to that.
I always say that to people. Come into my office. I guarantee you, if you went through my office, you'd be like, oh, she didn't get that done exactly perfect. It's like that's what makes us human. It's these imperfections.
Right, and so they get in there and they kind of expose that. And of course, if you start to dig in somewhere, you're going to find something going wrong. And so then they kind of exploit that. But that's not to say that they shouldn't be looking at what's going wrong.
Right.
They absolutely should. That's so important to a well-functioning government. But at the same time, there's a sense, especially from Democrats right now, that Republicans are kind of going on some fishing expeditions and kind of digging around just to find anything and then to really blow it up.
I heard somebody that I know who's in one of these inside the Beltway kind of enterprises. And he said something to me that I have to always attribute. That's not my thought. and because I thought it was so insightful. It's not my insight, and so I'd like to credit back that I heard it from somebody else. That his interpretation of where the politics are and what's being discussed in how the government works is the tail wagging the dog. It's not Congress looking at the workings of government and saying, you know, as a policy reason, I don't think we should have that program, or I think we should have a different program, or I think that could be done more efficiently. Instead, it's the news media picks up something that could be a big story, a scandal, and then they dig in. It's working in reverse. Congress should be the ones setting the agenda, figuring out what makes government work better. And instead, they're just picking up things that are percolating in the news media. I thought that was very interesting.
I think also there's a somewhat symbiotic relationship, particularly when you've got this 24-hour news cycle, the rise of cable television, which is, you know, it's 24 hours a day. They're constantly looking for material. And then you have, say, instances like the IRS, quote unquote, scandal. Where you have members of Congress who are happy to feed that that 24/7 cycle with material as quickly as it comes out. And with the IRS story, I'm not sure. I don't think the full story has entirely come out exactly what was going on. It was clearly in terms of these exempt organizations, there were some questionable practices going on. But it seems now that they were targeting both liberal and conservative organizations or giving them increased scrutiny. And which was not the certainly not the initial take on the situation.
Yeah. And then you get the sense, if you're inside the Beltway, you get the sense that Congress is kind of disappointed that they didn't that the story you do you get the sense that they were disappointed that the story wasn't worse. And I want to talk about in the next half of the show. I do want to talk about what are the big issues that you're covering and sort of your forecasts and predictions of where you think, where you think things will sort of come to a final resting place with sequestration and budget cuts and furloughs and RIFs. But we do need to take our mid-show break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
GEICO's famous for saving people money on car insurance. And now, if you're a federal employee, you could be saving even more. In fact, you may already qualify for a special federal discount from GEICO. If you're a federal employee or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, FLIOA, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you could be saving hundreds of dollars. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings. GEICO got its start back in 1936, specifically to serve federal employees. Today, we're still making it easy for federal employees to save money on car insurance. If you're a federal employee, you may qualify for a special federal employee discount. Or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you may also qualify. See how much you could be saving. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings. GEICO's famous for saving people money on car insurance. And now, if you're a federal employee, you could be saving even more. In fact, you may already qualify for a special federal discount from GEICO. If you're a federal employee or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, FLIOA, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you could be saving hundreds of dollars. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings.
I'm Bill Bransford, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Fed Talk brings you inside information on hot topics in the federal community. From the halls of Congress to federal agencies, get the latest on the laws, regulations, and activities that directly impact federal employees. Tune in to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, as we bring in the experts to bring you inside the issues.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and I am hosting this morning's show. We're calling it the Reporters Roundtable. And with me, the reporters that I do have with me this morning, talking about topics that are of importance that they cover on the federal beat to federal employees, is Kelly Lunny of GovExec. I have Sean Riley of the Federal Times and Josh Hicks of the Washington Post, who writes the Federal Live blog. Kelly, are you there?
I'm here.
Kelly, I wanted to start with you. I said to our listeners as we went out for the last break that when we came back, we'd start talking about, you know, what are you all covering? What are the hot topics? What's the inside baseball on these topics? Everybody always wants to know, you know, if you're inside the federal community, you know, for months, DOD employees, you know, wanted to know, will they get furloughed? Will they get furloughed?
Right.
And so, Kelly, tell us what the hot topics are right now, even though it's August and Congress is out.
Well, furloughs definitely are hot topics. I mean, I'm in Norfolk, Virginia, in the Hampton Roads area, and you know this place has a huge military presence,
right.
Active duty, but also many, many civilians, and that is the hot topic down here. Now, defense reduced the number of furlough days from 11 to 6 just a few days ago, but people are still mad about it. You know, I mean, they think that. You know, even though they're not going to have as many as they originally thought they were, they're just mad at the fact that they have to have even one. So the furloughs, sequestration in general, is obviously something that has been with us for a while and will probably be with us for at least a few months into fiscal 2014,
yeah.
If not longer. And, you know, another thing that readers are always interested in and something that I've been covering for years, and Sean and Josh as well, is just the various pieces of legislation, provisions that get stuck into bigger bills that have to do with rolling back, reducing federal employees' pay and benefits. It comes up in the unlikeliest of places, and it has since 2011. So those are the big things that I've been covering lately. I also have been doing a lot of stories about the challenges facing military families, especially now that we're out of Iraq and the drawdown is happening in Afghanistan, and just how transitioning and reintegrating into civilian life is impacting service members and also their families.
Hmm. Well, Kelly, after we go through around the table, we're going to come back and ask you your predictions for where things are going to come to their final resting place. You know, the largest single part of the federal workforce, DOD, almost 800,000 employees, you know, they're worried about the 2014 budget and what it'll mean to them. But, Sean,
yep.
How different is what you're covering than what Kelly's covering?
Oh, there's a lot of overlap, obviously. You know, for our readership, Defense Department's decision, Secretary Hagel's decision to reduce the number of furlough days is a very big story for us. And, you know, keeping up with legislation, I think the House version of the 2014 Defense Appropriations Bill would essentially bar DOD from furloughing employees in the future. And I wouldn't be surprised, assuming there is some sort of budget agreement, which is obviously an enormous if right now,
right.
We could well find its way into the final legislation. Another area that I've been covering, which is sort of a traditional focus of Federal Times, is the Postal Service, which coincidentally is going to announce its third quarter financial results in an hour or so.
Uh-huh.
So it'll be interesting what comes out of that.
I don't think it's going to be good.
Well, it may be a little better than expected, actually. I mean, it's not going to be, are they rolling money? No, but interestingly, their package business has been growing. I think they've had some success in cost cutting. They had, you know, a ton of buyouts in the last year or two. And so it may be a little more positive than expected. The irony is that the better the Postal Service does financially, at least in a relative term, I think the harder it becomes for Congress to deal with any kind of
right.
significant postal reform,
yeah,
just
right.
because
yeah.
At this point, I think Congress is going to defer or put off whatever it can possibly put off. And if the Postal Service doesn't have its back to the wall, if it can still pay its employees and its vendors to the end of the day, well, we can let this one wait another month or so.
But isn't it how the Congress has played everything for the last 5 years?
A lot of it, yeah. I think it's ironic with the Postal Service, though, because it's, you know, its financial situation has been so dire.
Dire.
I mean,
yeah.
they
yeah.
owe the Treasury $15 billion, you know, with a B. You know, at one point they were down to about 4 days cash flow. I mean, this is an organization, you know, a $65 billion organization. And so they really have been in pretty dire circumstances. But yet Congress is reluctant to take steps like, you know, ending Saturday mail delivery, or modifying a requirement that the Postal Service pre-fund, as they say, a retirement healthcare fund for future retirees. It's just been difficult for them to take any steps on this because the Postal Service, it affects almost every American. And they have, they employ 500,000 people, and a lot of those employees are represented by unions that are very politically active.
Mm-hmm. They're running commercials now. If you watch cable TV at night, the postal unions are running commercials about the good things that the Postal Service does, mm-hmm. and it's very interesting. They're now saying Congress is making us do these things, fund these things, mm-hmm. that we're the only agency or entity in the government that has to do this. And they've put us in this bind. It's very interesting that people, they're finding a way to sort of speak out because Congress really has the platform. That's all I've always said that in the last few years. Federal employees, the individual federal employee, not only do they not have a platform, but as all of you have noticed, if they do speak out, it's with such trepidation about getting quoted wrong or misstepping. And then their situation worsens. But before we move on to Josh, I have one question for you, Sean, about what you were reporting. Because I read, that was big news yesterday or the day before, the DOD was cutting their furlough day down. Mm-hmm. And as I understood it, it was like, quote unquote, they found money, right?
A big part of
where'd it. Where'd they find it?
Well, that is a great question.
If that's why, if you're Kelly, now you go back out and you start talking to people in the shipyard and they're like, how could we be that poorly run? It's because they're so big. They're so big and they have so many tentacles and the money's in so many different places that they really don't have a hand. That's what you're left with, Sean. They don't really have a handle on where all the money is.
Well, I think, like any large organization, and I think this applies to private sector companies as well, as federal entities, there's some slack. And, two of the big things that happened were, one, they apparently decided that there were some, we're withdrawing our military forces from Afghanistan. Yeah. They decided that there was some equipment that they didn't need to move, at least not in FY13, so they can put that back. Also, they got approval from Congress to reprogram, I think, about close to $10 billion, and that apparently gave them some flexibility to move money, from acquisition accounts into operations and maintenance, which would pay people's salaries. Mm-hmm. And but I think a fascinating question, which I'm not sure is, I'll be interested to see how closely or how much effort the Obama administration puts into trying to answer, is that once we're through this round of FY13 sequestration, to what extent are agencies going to have to report, or will anyone be taking a look at exactly how they made these cuts? Because the initial prediction was they were going to be draconian across the board, right. No flexibility, and it seems that in some places they have been able to find more flexibility. The IRS a day or two ago just announced they were postponing a furlough day that was going to be scheduled for August 30th because they managed to find savings in other areas. Now they'll decide in next month whether they need any additional furlough days by the end of the fiscal year. So they have been able to do at least, perhaps you need to give financial managers some credit for this, they have been able to find more flexibility and latitude, I think, than was initially expected. But the question is, where DOD's had to make, or at least according to numbers from the Office of Managed Budget, $37 billion in cuts. Exactly where have they cut? From right. What, what accounts did that money come out
right.
of?
That is an excellent point. Like, when are we all going to hear about where that came from? But I want to get to Josh and I want to ask him, because you're all covering the same big story, but it's very interesting to me, the little places and the distinctions and where you're focused. Josh, tell us where you are.
Oh, well, definitely looking at furloughs also and this upcoming, the efforts anyways to pass some postal reform and we'll be taking a look at the financials that are coming out with the Postal Service. And I think Sean is right. Financial situation for the post office is it's not good. It's they're not in the black right now, and I don't think they will be here when they announce their third quarter results. But they're certainly kind of trending more in the right direction. I think that's something that the unions are really emphasizing because they want to get rid of this pre-funding requirement where they have to pre-fund their retirement. Health benefits.
And I saw that commercial last night on cable. I was watching a cable TV news show, and all of a sudden this commercial pops up, and it was from one of the unions. And I thought, where'd they get that kind of money to do a commercial? but man, they it was very clear, their message, and their message was, we're not the ones being inefficient. Congress is the one making us do this. We're the only ones that have to do this, and Congress will not make decisions about other kinds of reform that you could do to the organization to save it. It was really good. You know, when they talk about messaging in this town, you know, messaging is really in one place in government. And it was interesting to see that the unions were being able to really, you know, start mimicking how, you know, how others have been messaging against them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're definitely, I mean, they've been pressing that hard with us. And, you know, we do kind of feature that information in our articles that they're talking about this pre-funding issue. But even then, we'll kind of get a call and say, well, you know, it wasn't focused on enough because this really, you're not getting it. This is really the one,
this
is the central issue.
Yeah, you should see this commercial. But what else, Josh, do you have your eye on?
Well, the going back to these so-called scandals, you know, it looks like Republicans are going to want to take a closer look at the FEC's relationship with the IRS. So there was right after the IRS controversy kind of exploded, and maybe even before, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader on the Senate side, had kind of presented this narrative that this IRS controversy was indicative of bullying on the part of the Obama administration, basically bullying the president's opponents or even his enemies. And that the FEC was all, he'd also, you know, implicated the FEC and said that they were involved too. So, so now they've kind of opened that up. They found some emails, where Lois Lerner, who everybody knows from the IRS controversy, had someone, an FEC attorney had contacted her to find out the status of a group that had applied for tax exempt status. And you're not supposed to, if a group, the law says that if a group has not been approved yet, or if application is pending, or if they've been rejected, you cannot release their information to the public, and you're not even really supposed to talk about them or even acknowledge that they had an application. However, if they have been approved, you can put their information out there. You can put information out there about their donors, and there's actually a public list that the IRS puts out, you know, on their website, and you can just kind of go in there and check and see if these groups have been approved. So this FEC attorney could have really just done that, but anyways, he had contacted Lois Lerner and said basically, what's going on with this group? We're investigating them, and have they been approved for tax exempt status? And somehow, we don't know exactly how, but somehow,
but you're
she
about
had,
to find out how. I can tell.
That's what they're looking into now. So Republicans are looking into how did she kind of tip, or did she even tip them off that this group had not been approved? And basically, I think her in the email suggested that she seemed kind of confused by the whole thing, and basically said, I think I may have pointed him to that public list that would have, that's public information anyways, and that would have told him that this group had not been approved, but. You know, maybe she didn't necessarily say to them, this group has been rejected or is in the process.
So the plot's really starting to thicken over there at IRS.
So they're going to dig around with the FEC, too, now and see if they can kind of come up with anything from that side.
Yeah. We're going to take our last break here at Fed Talk. And when we come back, we're going to get predictions from each of our reporter friends. You're listening to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is Geico anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that Geico isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how Geico actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, Geico saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like Geico. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. Geico.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com. Then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact Geico today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and I'm hosting today's show. It's the Fed Talk Press Roundup, and we have three fantastic reporters with us. cover the federal beat, we have Josh Hicks of the Washington Post. He writes the Federal Eye blog. Sean Riley from the Federal Times and Kelly Lunny of GovExec. Kelly, you still with us?
I'm here.
We have about 10 minutes left. That's 3 minutes per reporter. And I'm looking for you to give us your predictions for where things are going to stand after Labor Day.
Well, I guess I'll go first. I guess I can just make a prediction. I would think about the budget situation.
Yeah.
I think that's, and I've got an indication from lawmakers themselves who have, I mean, not even their aides, they themselves have told me they think that this, we're probably going to end up with another continuing resolution, which is basically just continuing with the status quo rather than having a comprehensive long-term budget. So I don't see hope that they're gonna forge a deal here. And I think also, I think we were talking earlier about article that one of my colleagues wrote, Lori Montgomery wrote about, you know, a few Republican aides have
on the Post
in the Post. Yeah. A few Republican aides have stepped down and they were kind of the people who were pretty deeply involved in budget negotiations in the past. And even though they didn't have success, obviously, at least they were kind of the best hope during those times. And those people have left, and that's seen as kind of maybe an omen of what's to come, and that you know, there's not much hope of reaching a deal, and they don't want to maybe be around when things fall apart.
But you know, Josh, is anyone surprised they're not going to reach a deal? I mean, what are we in our fifth budget cycle without a budget? 5 years? I don't, you know, other than inside the Beltway, I wonder. I get the sense no one else is listening. No one else cares. Certainly, Wall Street leading up to sequestration was frightened. Sequestration hit, and it was like, the sky hasn't fallen. And then the market took off. So I sort of wonder what it really means to the greater American public, you know, an inability yet again to reach a budget deal. For federal employees, it's just going to mean sequestration and whether that leads to furloughs. And Sean, your prediction on that?
Yeah, if I could interject, I mean, I think that, you know, I agree with Josh. I think there will be a CR. I think, you know, the other issue, as we were talking about during the break, was what happens, you know, the government is expected to hit its debt ceiling later this fall, and there is some expectation that negotiations of the budget and how deeply, you know, whether to leave sequestration in place, whether to cut even more deeply, will be tied into getting congressional approval to raise the debt ceiling again. And that could be a particularly difficult and wrenching fight. And
wasn't it the last time?
It was terrible.
And
I think what members of Congress may be aware of is that their reputation, both the reputation of Congress, the reputation of the administration, took a terrific hit back in August of 2011.
Congress polled.
People did pay attention to that.
Right, they did. Congress polled at 8%. Their approval rating was 8%. And do you remember that? I think actually the Post ran it. They ran approval ratings, American public approval ratings of other people or entities like Castro and Russia during the Cold War. And Congress's approval was lower than all of that.
I think North Korea's dictator may have had a higher approval
rating. That's right. It was hysterical. But a sad commentary on our affair, Sean.
Yeah, well, I think you're right in terms of the budget wrangling that is basically pretty much normal now. I mean, Congress has passed an on-time budget perhaps three times in the last 30 years. I mean, CRs are the norm, and the public for the most part doesn't pay attention, and probably there's no particular reason for them to. But when you get into something like the debt ceiling crisis, where there's a pretty widespread expectation that the U.S. did default, the Treasury did default on its obligations, there would be a financial catastrophe. People did pay attention then. So I think Congress and leadership, as well as the White House, are probably well aware that they could pay a price politically if they don't get this worked out.
Kelly.
Yeah, I just to add to what Sean was saying about the public and their the attention span with CRs and the debt ceiling. You know, the debt ceiling is one of those things where if we default and there has to be some sort of priority list for what gets paid, people might not get their best benefits. People might not get their paychecks. And that's when people start paying attention. And it's the same thing with sequestration. You know, we haven't had sort of that culmination, that, you know, disaster of asteroid hitting the Earth from sequestration yet. But if it continues, you know, there's that lag time. Things are going to start to go downhill. People are going to start to see it affect their daily lives with government services, with
you know, the timeliness of benefits with, you know, perhaps the FAA doesn't get a pass in fiscal 2014 and flights really are delayed terribly. And I think that, you know, sequestration is going to be with us for a while. You know, the CR will pass, the government won't shut down, both sides will take credit for not shutting down the government, everybody will pat themselves on the back, but nothing will be done about sequestration because there's 9 legislative days until October 1st, and the best thing they're going to do is not shut the government down. So we'll enter fiscal 2014 with sequestration, and then it'll be with us because the disaster hasn't happened. So there won't be a grant bargain. There won't be a rewind of sequestration. It'll just get hacked away, sort of piecemeal, the way that it has been this fiscal year, with some groups having the clout to get the flexibilities. And, you know, it'll just sort of, it'll be death by a thousand paper cuts.
And so that sort of raises these other questions for the federal community, and that is, what does that bring them with more sequestration? You know, does that mean they're getting furloughs? Does that mean we're running RIFs? Because we haven't had furloughs and RIFs since the 90s.
Well, it was interesting. At the briefing, there was a briefing by a couple of defense officials on Tuesday when they announced the reduction in the number of furlough days. And it's pretty clear that, you know, if with another round of sequestration in 2014, DOD is looking at a reduction in force. So that's one option that's on the table.
They're saying RIF.
Yeah, they are. I mean, they're not and they're not saying exactly what, you know, how big a RIF or how many RIFs or in what areas, but they are saying that is an option. And, you know, the comptroller for DOD is on record as saying that, you know, he's not, if this is a couple months ago, but if there were another round of sequestration, he was not going to, you know, they were not going to just, I think he used the word mess. And deal with this mess again, they would be looking at permanent workforce reductions.
Yeah. And there's no guarantee that active duty military members will have the same sort of protections that they have this time around if, you know, we still have this in fiscal 2014.
I think that's the sacred cow. I don't see Congress going for active duty.
That's an administration decision, but I agree. I mean, I would be surprised that they did, but it was, you know, the White House specifically exempted military pay from this sequester, but it's hard to imagine that they would do otherwise in the future. But it's, you know, it's nothing. I think we've all seen in the last couple of years that nothing's guaranteed.
Right.
What's an interesting issue about the debt ceiling is we talk about hitting the debt ceiling and this real showdown now that maybe they will not approve raising the debt ceiling. And what no one's talking about is what's the logistics of that when they don't? What happens? Like, who doesn't get paid first? Do we all
Nobody
get in
knows.
Line? How does that work? Do we get in line? You know, it's like, you know, primary liens and secondary lien holders. Who's first in line?
Well, I think that's a Treasury Department decision, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we have huge political consequences because I think the preference of Treasury officials would be make sure, you know, you pay your bond, you know, the people you keep the debt payments going, that you pay the holders of all those Treasury bills. Because that, if you don't, then you're risking a financial meltdown. But on the other hand, are you going to give bondholders preference over Social Security recipients?
Right, that's what I was thinking.
And that's going to be, you know, be very hard. I mean, it might make sense from a financial management perspective, but it's sure be a hard sell with the American public.
Yeah, Josh. Right.
And who wants to make that decision? You know.
Exactly.
Well, none of them. None of them want to.
It's definitely being, you know, it's being stuck between a rock and a hard place. But I guess if I had to make a just kind of an educated guess on what they would do in that situation, maybe they would, I think they would live up to their obligations with the taxpayers and the people who paid into Social Security and let the bondholders suffer a little bit. And I think there's a
the
sense
markets
that maybe
would go nuts.
They would, but maybe, you know, it is the United States of America has fairly deep pockets, and there's a sense that probably we could recover, even though it would be awful, we could recover. Whereas, you know, the idea of not paying Social Security benefits to people who paid into that system is just almost completely unpalatable. So it's neither option is good, but if I had to guess, I would think they'd pay their Social Security benefits.
But isn't it what's interesting? We have 20 seconds. What's interesting is no one talks about that. In the whole debt ceiling issue, no one actually talks about, well, practically speaking, what happens when we won't raise the debt ceiling. They talk conceptually, but they don't talk practically. I need to thank my three guests for joining me at my federal news reporters roundtable. I'm hoping that everyone will come back and join us maybe in 6 or 8 months. Kelly Lunney of GovExec, Sean Riley of Federal Times, Josh Hicks of The Washington Post, the Federal Eye blog. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having us.